reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll discuss staffing and funding issues at the Bureau of Prisons with AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel, as well as a number of other workplace concerns with local presidents John Garvey, Mike Garrisi, and Vernon Steed. And later, we'll go inside the Occupy Oakland movement and also report from an AFGE rally to support Social Security Administration workers. With us now, Dale Desotel, president of the Council of Prison Locals. Dale, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The Council of Prison Locals recently held a rally outside the Department of Justice in support of Bureau of Prisons workers. Tell us about the rally.
The rally was to bring notice to the Department of Justice that the Equal Employment Opportunity Coalition did a survey at four institutions in the Bureau of Prisons selected by the agency to address the issue of retaliation. Retaliation on those individuals who felt necessary to report an EEO complaint. Filing formal EEO complaints historically take time and money and also ruin morale. But here lately, the retaliation because of people filing an EEO complaint is off, it's way above normal. And people are feeling the strain, the harassment, the reduction of opportunities for advancement, the ruining their careers, the stress levels, all of the things that can be negative from any kind of retaliation. And to even have discrimination in the workforce in 2011 is just absurd to begin with. And then to have reports of complaints of actual findings from a commission that goes in. I mean, it's not like the employees reported the retaliation. They responded to the survey. And it was an outside agency that came in and did this survey, and it's their report. And we felt like there was nothing being done. We had spoke about the issue in Seattle. We had a labor management relations meeting, brought the issue up, and asked what the agency was going to do. And the response was not well received. So Mike Castell, who is our National Fair Practice Coordinator, decided to work with Augusta Thomas, who is AFGE National Fair Practice Coordinator, and all of the good people at AFGE, and orchestrated this time and this march in front of DOJ to bring that attention to Eric Holder, the Attorney General. The laws are there. There is ways of dealing with these issues, and there are ways of dealing with individuals. And retaliation is simply not in the book. There are laws that deal with it. It's just not being enforced. And that's why we did it.
Tell us about the report. Obviously, you were speaking about it earlier, but what were some of the details of the November 2010 GAO report that examined this culture of retaliation within the Bureau of Prisons?
They went in and interviewed individuals who had filed the EEO complaints. And the responses they got from them were that since I filed the complaint, I've been threatened with my job. I've been told I'd never be promoted. I've been told that I'll never have a career, that I've ruined my career. And these people were devastated. You know, first of all, they were discriminated against, or they felt as they were. And then this retaliation came. So it's a double whammy. Not only were they discriminated against, but and the GAO report mandated the agency to do something, to create some kind of something.
Has the agency done anything to rectify these problems that the report identified?
Not to our satisfaction, and then nothing that shows that they've done anything.
As the council president, what is your response to that inaction?
Our response to that was to continue to try to get the message out. And that's why we did the rally, so that we could get that message open and clear that the agency has not responded. And the agency has not done what the GAO has asked them to do.
At the conclusion of the rally, how did you feel the members responded to it? Was it something that helped their morale in this case?
Absolutely. Anytime their message is brought forward, and especially in front of the Department of Justice, we feel like we've accomplished that part, that task, that task that day. We're not finished. This is not over, and nothing has changed as of yet. But we have brought the attention to the limelight, which is our job. And with the help of AFGE and all of the people, that brothers and sisters that walked with us, and we had a good time, and we enjoyed it, and we felt like we brought the message out into the open.
By these steps that you're taking, getting the message out, holding rallies, informational pickets, things of that nature, do you think that you're inching closer to a response from the agency to deal with the issue?
We certainly hope so. We are at a disadvantage somewhat because we're in between directors. We haven't had a new director named. So what Mr. Holder would deal with, or his people at this point, would be the agency as a whole. We have an acting director, but we're still looking for some direction that continually that would continually change this culture of retaliation.
You and I have talked about this issue a number of times off the air, and you noted that the Bureau has a 0% tolerance.
Correct.
On this issue. Do you find it odd that despite that 0% tolerance, that the report found so many areas that needed to be corrected?
It does sound crazy. It shouldn't be. Zero tolerance means zero tolerance. I mean, we have drug policies. We have no use of drugs. It's zero tolerance. Weapons, zero tolerance. NEO discrimination, zero tolerance. So what is the reason that we have retaliation? It's because we're not enforcing the laws upon those who continue to discriminate.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Dale Desautels, president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Dale, what are the next steps for you and the council in this fight?
Well, we certainly await the agency to give us some response and work with us or show us some kind of concern that they are willing to work on this issue. We do have a joint work group that is meeting next week to address some of these issues. But that's just a drop in the bucket compared to what needs to be done. Any time we find retaliation, if we're going to say it's zero tolerance, then that individual has to be dealt with. Just as if an employee would cross the line with an inmate, we are dealt with, disciplined or whatever. This should happen as well. And we feel like until that happens, until the message is all the way to those who do participate in discrimination activity, it isn't going to change a whole lot.
Another key issue that you're dealing with in the Bureau of Prisons is the lack of staffing and funding that you all feel you need to get the job done. Tell us about that and the impact.
The impact, I just got an email yesterday that now the ratio, we were once at 3.7, 3.9, and risen to 4.1 inmates per staff. The last email I got at one institution was now up to 6 to 1. The overcrowding of the inmates of the prisons is out of control. Everyone knows about it, but this money crunch, the lack of facilities, what do? It's been addressed. Attorney General's addressed it. The DOJ's addressing it. However, when Congress says you only have so much money, then it limits the agency from hiring the amount of people needed to bring that ratio down. So even if we hired another 2,000 employees this year, which I don't see us doing, but if we did, it still wouldn't bring the ratio down to where we were 10 years ago. And to manage inmates, you have to have staff. There's no way we can talk to these inmates. There's no way we can deal with these inmates if you got to talk to 25 of them a day, where we used to have to only talk to a few to know what was going on in the institution. Now you have so many, you can't get to any of them. It's just overcrowded so much that the staffing is not there. And then if something does happen, if they do have a disagreement or a fight, then we have less people to respond. So the safety of our staff, because we don't have enough, is what brings the concern, and that's why we continue to try to find ways to get this message out.
I think you hit on a key topic there, and that's the safety of the institution. Talk about that a little bit, because I'm not sure that the general public understands the community risk, the risk to the workers inside the facility of being understaffed in a federal prison.
Yes. When I started almost 26 years ago, we had a lot more staff per day, per shift than we have now. In other words, we had two officers in every unit. We had several officers that were free on the compound to check the fences, to check the doors, to assist other staff. We had other staff that were not specifically correctional officers that were doing work in the kitchen or doing work in maintenance or doing work in the business office or in the hospital that could respond in case there was a fight, in case there was an incident. Other people could respond. And so our assaults were less than they are today. But over the years, we have streamlined and streamlined and streamlined and cut all of the things that we think we didn't need or the agency did. And all the while, we're screaming that you're reducing the level of safety in these institutions, not only because when we're alone with inmates, we're vulnerable. We have no weapons. We have a radio. We have no pepper spray, which we've been fighting to try to get as a result of the Jose Rivera murder. We have stab-proof vests, and all these things help, but we're not there. We just don't have the opportunity to fight off 20 people when you're by yourself. When there's two officers around, or when there's other officers or other staff members around, inmates are much less apt to do anything because they know they're being watched.
And it's important to note that the inmate population has increased during this time.
Continues.
And it's a more aggressive inmate population.
It's a different population. Absolutely. Absolutely. When I came in, an inmate that was doing time, most of them I found were interested in doing their time. Leave me alone. If I can get a little work, get a job and do some work, it would pass my time. And it's a lot easier. Nowadays, we have inmates that come from the street who are already fighting for life in the streets, trying to survive in the streets, and it's a violent lifestyle they come from, so they don't know anything else. When you put them in this situation, and we have all of these gangs and different cultures mixed in these prisons, and there's a struggle there. So even that, without looking at any of the other factors, less staff or what have you, creates another situation that's volatile, another violent situation, because that's the lifestyle that they're used to. That's their culture. And they come into prison. Yeah, they're in prison, but now it's a city within a city in the prison. And that's what's so dangerous, because it's not so much that they're after the staff. There's just not enough staff to watch what they're doing or to know what they're doing.
And you mentioned the staffing ratios, staff to inmate ratios earlier, but it's also important to note that many times you and your fellow correctional officers are asked to supervise anywhere from 150 to 300 inmates at one time alone.
Yes, they're in the housing units from 180, where I come from in Oakdale, from 180 now up to about 240 per housing unit, one person.
What are your colleagues say about that? What's the concern there?
Well, they try not to think about it because they would quit if you thought about it. The concern is that the overcrowding, it's a domino effect. In every institution, we have what we call special housing for inmates that are disruptive, for inmates that cannot function in this setting, or for those who feel threatened. We would have a special housing unit to put them, not only to protect them, but to protect us. And the overcrowding has caused us to use the special housing for regular housing, for overcrowding from the penitentiaries, for people in the penitentiaries that have caused problems. We have to house them. And so that takes up the space, and that takes up our option to deal with other disruptive inmates or groups. So we have no way to discipline them. And that's what creates this problem, because not only does it, they're already a culture of violence, but we have no way to deal with them because we have nowhere to put them. We have nowhere to isolate them. And within the laws, rules, and regulations, we just housed with those guys that have already had a problem on the rec yard or what have you, and they come in this housing unit at night, and they're already mad, and there's already issues, and then there's only one person to deal with it.
Dale Desotel, president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Dale, thank you for your time. Come back and see us again soon.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss the importance of the labor movement with AFGE General Services Administration Local 2275 President John Garvey.
Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to buy items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount with promo code AFGEMember. That's all one word. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by John Garvey, president of AFGE's General Services Administration, Local 2275 in the Bay Area, San Francisco. John, welcome to the program.
Jason, it's my pleasure to be here. It's an outstanding opportunity to be on your program today.
We've got you here today at AFGE's District 12 training in Oakland. Tell me about what you're doing here and what you've seen so far.
I've interacted with several AFGE leaders, and the class that I'm taking is new leaders training, and I'm actually fortunate because my agency is very progressive, and the labor relations individual I'm working with right now approved of this training. In the past, it was disapproved because that particular class was perceived by the prior labor relations representative as union building, and I've taken day one of it. It is not union building. It is a really beneficial class, mutually beneficial to both the agency and the union.
Talk about that a little bit, about that importance of ramping up your skills and training at events like this.
School is never out for the professional, and the better that I'm trained, I can better serve the membership and the managers, because we work in an environment at GSA. We're trying to provide an outstanding product to the taxpayer, and basically we're a real estate organization, and our agency and our membership and our union, we exist to promote the efficiency of the federal government. So the better trained we are, we can actually ensure that America remains strong. And what I brought today was our national agreement contract. And what I was sharing with you right before we turn on the microphone here is basically that's the rules of the workplace. And most agencies have this agreement document. We have actually 36 articles. Now, you're in Oakland, California today. And this past year, I saw the Oakland A's play the Baltimore Orioles. I know this is a national show. And so when those two teams met at the Oakland Coliseum, those managers and their staff at the baseball game were very proficient in the rules of baseball. That was their job. The same principle transpires into the federal workplace, is all employees and managers really need to be proficient in the rules of the workplace. And that's usually the agreement document between both parties.
Do you find that the more the document is used, the more it's referenced, the more efficient the agency runs, and the easier it is for the union and the agency to work together?
Absolutely. I started in the union as a steward, and then I eventually became president. But what happens when people come to us for assistance, a lot of times it's late in the game, and there's certain articles in that contract, for example, time and attendance or performance, and they really don't have a grasp of those articles. So if people in all, not just GSA, but all agencies in the workplace, and this can apply outside the federal government too, you really need to be knowledgeable about how your workplace operates, especially if you're in a unionized environment.
Talk for a minute about the time that you're going through as a federal employee. Obviously, it's very difficult. You're under a 2-year pay freeze.
There have been proposals to extend that, proposals to increase the amount that you contribute to your retirement as a federal employee. What does all this mean to you right now?
We had a membership meeting recently, and we had a question and answer period, and several of the members and guests, they asked questions pertaining to the pay freeze, how long that would last, and would their retirement continue to be eroded, and if there was buyout opportunities. I don't have the answers to those questions. I do see in the Federal Times they have a lot of dialogue. What we do encourage people to do is if you go to the post office and you get a 44 cents stamp, you can contact your decision makers and try to impact, you know, affect change. But federal employees, just like President John Gage mentioned, we realize America is at a crossroads, and a lot of people are sacrificing. We're at war now. So I believe a lot of the federal employees are really have stepped up to the plate, and they're really not asking for that much. They just wanted to be treated in a fair manner, and they're willing to continue the sacrifice that needs to happen.
When you see federal employees being attacked by legislators, by the press, what does that do for the morale of the workforce?
There's usually two sides to every story, and I'm a trained historian, so I don't really believe what I read in the media or the newspapers all the time. There's always other issues that are not brought to the forefront. What our concern at our local is we kind of gauge the temperature of the workplace by the complaint activity. What we've seen is there's an increase in the number of equal employment opportunity complaints. There's an increase in the number of grievances. A lot of people come to us and claim or allege that they're in a hostile work environment. So what we try to do is listen to them and try to resolve conflict. We're basically a bridge between management. We're trying to make the workplace work. And this shirt that I have on, it says AFG, proud to make America work. But I used to be a suit and tie person. We worked in the financial district. Now I work in the Civic Center in the San Francisco area. But I'm very proud to wear these shirts as often as possible. And people come up to me and ask me what AFG is. AFG has been around for, I believe, since 1932 and has a tremendous history. And we have a lot of the rights and benefits in the workplace that we enjoy today because we've had tremendous leadership in AFG, and that continues to happen.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with John Garvey, president of AFGE GSA Local 2275. John, what brought you to the labor movement and specifically to serve at AFGE?
I've been with my particular federal agency for 23 years. And when I first started, I sat next to a gentleman. His name was Lou. He retired from the Air Force. But people would come to him and ask him his advice, and I would just overhear a lot of these discussions. He wasn't a union rep. He was just a coworker helping a coworker. And what he initially told me was, John, you're a junior executive, and AFG is blue-collared. It's mostly postal employees, and it's weak. And guess what? You don't need to join it. You can still enjoy all the benefits. And for 12 years, I didn't have any desire to participate in AFG. I knew unions are valuable, but it just wasn't on my radar. And then as time progressed, I had some issues. You know, in the workplace, we have some outstanding managers and some that are not so outstanding. And sometimes you have conflict in the workplace. So sometimes the union, it does serve value that to get answers to your questions. So that was a benefit to me, and they saw how I handled certain situations, and I was asked to be a steward. And from a steward, I eventually went to become the local president. And it's a position that I really enjoy. And the best thing about being president is the thank you notes that we get from the members, because we have people that are in distress. They're very emotional. Sometimes they tell us that, you know, life is not worth living and things like that. And we, as much as possible, we try to help everyone be successful.
Do you find that your involvement in AFGE and serving as a local president has advanced your career as a federal employee at GSA?
I have much greater visibility. I haven't gotten any pay increases. And, you know, sometimes I think, not particular for me, but the gentleman I work with, his name's Curtis Phelps. He's the regional vice president. He's in charge of GSA locals in Hawaii, Arizona, Nevada, and California, and I sit right next to him in the union office. Curtis is an Air Force veteran. When he first came to GSA, he has a wealth of experience. He was sent to the Western White House to work with when Nixon was there, when President Richard Nixon was there. Eventually, he became in management, and when he left management, he got involved in the union. So he's at a very high level, and I work with him usually on a daily basis. And both of us, yes and no, if they stagnated or not. But success is not just your GS level. Success is waking up in the morning, knowing that you're doing something that you really believe in, and that you can make a positive difference in people's life. So I believe in that respect, yes, it has given me a tremendous, just like GSA, has given me a tremendous opportunity in my life to do some really wonderful things and meet some really wonderful people.
What are your goals going forward as we close out 2011 and move into 2012?
I look around the workplace, and I really want to have everyone be very happy to be there, and I want to try to eliminate people, their perception. Not sure if it's really reality, but if they believe they're being targeted or bullied, or there's sexism or racism, or they're being labeled. We're in the San Francisco Bay Area, and this is a very special place for me. I'm a native San Franciscan, and we have a large gay population. And a lot of our members of the LGBT community have come to us and told us they believe their sexual orientation is an issue, why they're coming into our office and why they believe they're being harassed or demoted or whatever. So that's a great concern for me. And I got involved in AFG because I'm one of these individuals that I don't like discrimination. I don't approve of it. I don't like harassment. I really want, like Rodney King said, let's just all get along. That's what I would like for the workforce, and especially the federal workforce. If they could put me out of business of doing union representational time and just say there is no complaint activity or there's not much, I would be so happy. So I don't perceive my attitude is not, I'm not just putting a Band-Aid on this, doing this. I'm with all these other individuals here. We're trying to make a positive change in the workplace. We're trying to work with management. We have some really good, strong relationships at GSA with the managers, that they have open door policies. So change is happening, and I see it since I've gotten involved. We have much stronger relationships. And I foresee in the future that it'll get even stronger. And again, the workplace will be a wonderful place to just come and do your work. And we have a very vital role as federal workers to our country and to the world to continue to make a positive change on this planet.
John Garvey, President, AFGE Local 2275. Thank you for your time, John.
Okay, thank you, sir.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn about pressing workplace concerns with AFGE local presidents Mike Garrissi and Vernon Steed.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Mike Garrissi, the president of AFGE Local 1978, the Department of Interior's Bureau of Reclamation. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
We've got you here today at AFGE's District 12 training in Oakland. Tell me about what you're doing here and what you've seen so far.
I've only been here a short period of time, coming in from another meeting, but what I've seen so far is really impressive. The number of union activists coming out participating in this always impresses me. Nothing would happen out here if it wasn't for us activists.
How important is it to have these trainings put on throughout the year?
I think it's number one priority, really, next to our legislative goals, because without educated activists, you're not going to be able to represent the people in your local properly.
What are some of the things that you've learned so far at this training and others?
This training, specifically different rights of representation in arbitration proceedings, the availability of resources that are out there for that, and other trainings, just basically the fact that our people are the biggest resource. Source of all, when we have to call upon others to help us out in situations, somebody's always been there before us.
Many people know of the Department of Interior. Obviously, it's a cabinet-level agency. But tell us about the Bureau of Reclamation and what you do there.
Okay, the Department of Interior has a lot of different bureaus and other different levels of organization, but the Bureau of Reclamation is one of those. But we deal with mainly the water issues and dams, hydroelectric generation west of the Mississippi. We're equivalent to the Army Corps of Engineers in the rest of the country, but primarily what we're involved with is water projects in the west. Like I said, the dams. We are the ones that were responsible for Hoover Dam, and which is where I come from.
Now, do you find that the work that you're doing really has an opportunity to change the direction of the country, given that we're under such a need for investment in infrastructure?
I honestly believe it does. I mean, we're a renewable energy source, and what we do actually pays our own salaries. We're off budget, so we're self-funding by the revenues from both the water and the power that we generate. And we're also considered national critical infrastructure, so if, what we do actually affects the lives of millions of people on a daily basis.
What goes through your mind when you see on the television or read in the newspaper about a crumbling infrastructure in this country, from roads and bridges to tunnels?
Well, not only as an activist, but as an American, it just breaks my heart because, I mean, that's what makes America strong. I honestly believe that. It's not just some a talking point that a lot of people use, but it's actually what's out there. That's part of your everyday existence.
Let's talk a little bit about your local 1978. What are some of the most pressing issues that you're tackling now?
Many of our pressing issues deal with, obviously, the same ones that most federal employees are fighting right now. It's a lot of the stagnation of pay, loss of awards, the budget cutting, but also it seems like there's a one-sidedness between management versus union that we have to constantly fight. It just seems like when it comes to disciplinary actions, that the decisions don't even follow the basic guidelines or precepts of the labor law that precedes us.
Why do you think that is?
I'm not really sure on that. I think some of it has a lack of training, or maybe just a higher level philosophy that maybe the workers don't matter at times. I was hoping that maybe from the administration top down, some of that would filter down, but we still have a lot of people in between that don't quite get it.
Now, you've been local president at 1978 for 7 years.
That's correct.
How has the relationship gone with management during that time?
It's kind of been a pendulum swing. I mean, we've had some good managers. When I came in, we actually had one manager that we thought was very tough, and we had to fight a lot on different things, but we had some successes. So that manager kind of moved on. We got another manager in there that was really good to work with. I mean, we didn't always see eye to eye, but we were able to work through things amicably and civilly, and a lot of our grievances and our arbitrations went down. Well, the pendulum swung back the other way. We got another manager now that believes in the hardline approach to everything, and now the pendulum swung back the other way, where we have multiple ULPs, arbitrations, grievances, and it's pretty sad.
What's the morale of the agency like during those times?
The morale of the agency overall is strong. I mean, it has a negative effect, obviously, on the people's perceptions of the management and all, but if anything, it definitely has strengthened our union.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Mike Garrisi, president of AFGE Local 1978 at the Department of Interior. Mike, as you know, federal employees have had a rough year. Two-year pay freeze with proposals to extend that, forced to contribute more to your retirement plan, a lot of uncertainty about the size of the federal workforce going forward. What are your thoughts on all of that?
I think that I can understand that all of America is feeling the pain right now. The federal government workers are probably going to be feeling it as much. But my problem with what's going on, it seems like the brunt of it's being placed on the federal workers. We're being demonized out there in the press by even our own lawmakers that we support. And that angers me quite a bit for that regard, because we are the backbone of this nation out there.
As a federal employee, do you think that the general public understands the services that you provide?
As a whole, the general public doesn't. I honestly believe that they're looking at these 30-second talking points that are being put out there in the media, and I think programs like this would have a direct impact on that. And I think it's also incumbent upon other federal employees getting out there and telling their neighbors, their own loved ones, to spread the word. Hey, look, we're not bad people. We're just like everybody else, just trying to make a living.
Talk about the skill set that's required to do what you do.
The skill set's pretty high. Basically, the education level is much higher with the regards to our positions. Now, my local actually covers a wide spectrum of positions. We represent professionals in the engineering trades, nursing. We also represent police officers, guides. We represent blue-collar workers from electricians, mechanics, power plant operators. And all those positions require a certain amount of skill, a lot of mathematics. Blue-collar positions are four-year journeyman type apprenticeship positions that people have to work to get. And we get hundreds of applicants every time for our positions, but you only select two or three out of those.
What brought you to the labor movement?
I saw a lot of injustice and inequity that was going on out there. I've never been the subject so much of that myself, but coming from me, that's kind of a lot to say, because I used to be the most anti-union activist out there, because I saw some wildcat strikes on carpenters unions years ago that went on a wildcat strike just over the wrong flavor of Kool-Aid in their cooler. But when I started seeing the reasoning behind why they were doing it, there were bigger issues involved with that. And that really opened my eyes to the things.
When you look at some of those bigger issues and you look at your own involvement in the labor movement, do you see how being involved, being a local president, serving AFGE has advanced your career as a federal employee?
Oh, it absolutely has. It's opened up many doors that I don't think would have been open to me had I not jumped into this. I have a bit of a military background, but I don't think that my pay, I don't think some of my education levels would have been as great as it is now had it not been for the Bureau of Reclamation and the federal government.
And as you look forward, what are your goals as a local president?
My goals as a local president is to try and bring the agency and the union union together to work towards better equal goals. I mean, we represent the same interests, so I think we have a good symbiotic relationship that we need to develop.
Mike Garrisi, president of AFGE Local 1978, the Department of Interior Bureau of Reclamation. Mike, thank you for your time.
And thank you.
We've been joined by Vernon Steed, the local president of AFGE's 1199, the Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. Vernon, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So today we've got you here at AFGE's District 12 training in Oakland, California. Tell us about what you've done so far.
Well, I'm glad to be here at the district training. As a local president, I am responsible for the maintaining the bargaining rights of over 1,200 employees at Nellis. We do our very best to make sure that the rights of all our employees are protected at all times.
And what kind of challenges do you face in making sure that those employees stay protected and that they keep their bargaining rights?
Well, the type of challenges that I personally deal with daily is making sure the employees understand that they do have rights. And with that, once they understand that they do have rights, we have to aggressively fight to protect those rights and to maintain that rights. And another challenge that I do have and I incur is make sure we maintain a healthy relationship with our management counterparts.
Do you find that management is receptive to that, wanting to work together with the union?
By and large, they are. We do have some areas of concern, but for the most part, our managers at Nellis do their very best to try to work with us. We do have our days, but normally we work together.
Along the way, you mentioned prior that you've been the local president there at Nellis for 10 years. What are some of your most proudest accomplishments and achievements as local president?
Well, some of my most proudest accomplishment was the opportunity to bring my local and management to an optimum level of working together. Now, of course, we've had some fights over the years, but my most proudest moment is that I changed my local from what it was to what it is today. It's a viable local that has a good relationship with the management staff at Nellis.
And having a good relationship with the management staff and being able to work together, do you think that that enables the Air Force Base as a whole to function more efficiently?
Most certainly. Most certainly. I really believe that in my heart.
And give me maybe an example or two of how that efficiency has gone through.
Well, in some cases, instead of filing the grievances in the UOPs, we come to the table and we bargain and we discuss the issue, which precludes a long, drawn-out fight that could last anywhere from 6 months to a year. Our goal is to hear the complaint, discuss it, and get the employee back to work.
During this time, obviously, it's a difficult time to be a federal employee. You all are under a two-year pay freeze. There have been proposals to extend that. There have been proposals for federal employees to contribute more to their pension plans than they already do now. You're asked to sacrifice a lot as a federal employee. What are your thoughts on all of that?
Well, I take my cue from President Gates and his staff. We don't believe that the sacrifices of this nation should be on the back of government employees. Of course, we want to support our government in doing our fair share. But I just do really believe, that the we're headed down the road of really abusing government employees, and we really need to watch it carefully.
And what are your members saying about that?
Members, of course, are saying basically the same thing, that they basically don't think that government employees should be the scapegoat, or we should be classed as the last frontier, for sacrifice. We believe that we should be, most definitely give our fair share.
Despite those challenges, do you find that people, particularly your members, are still enthusiastic about being a servant of the government and serving their country?
Yes. They are dedicated professionals. Mm-hmm. And one good sign of a professional is they can support the organization or the request, irregardless of how they affect them.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Vernon Steed, the president of AFGE's Air Force Local 1199 in Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. Vernon, you've also formulated a pretty strong and unique opinion on bargaining rights, and something that you would like to see is securing bargaining rights for every worker.
That's true.
Tell us about that.
I personally feel that every working individual should have some type of bargaining rights. I believe that all workers should have some type of rights, to include the military. I know that's a hot subject, but it's going to be my goal while I'm working in labor to develop the fight of the terms, to extend bargaining rights even to the military, some type of rights. They may be limited, but all workers, to include the military, should have some type of say-so in their work.
Why is that so important to you? Why is it that you believe that every worker should have bargaining rights?
I personally believe that it goes to the core of who we are as a democracy. We shouldn't ask a worker of our society to come out and to work and to sacrifice, and that worker have no input in his labor. I believe that from George Washington to Dr. King, the Civil Rights Movement, it's all about giving people say-so in their livelihood.
Do you think that say-so, that having that voice, provides an increased morale in the workplace for the employee?
Most certainly. I do believe. I do believe that if we had that structure in place, we would not have the Occupy Wall Street movement going on now. I believe that people, citizenry as a large, are just fed up with the status quo, and we need to take some action to correct it.
when you talk about the Occupy movement, obviously here in Oakland, it's been very visible this week. What are your thoughts on that?
I think personally, I think, of course, they're on the right track. Of course, we don't necessarily support the conflict between the occupiers and the police. But however, I do think the cause is honorable, because our nation at this time is going through a phase in which, okay, the working people are underclassed, they're underrepresented, and the Wall Street Occupy movement is trying to bring some changes to that. So I totally support the occupiers here in Oakland 100%, not the violence.
As you look back on your career, 10 years that you have served as a local president at AFGE, what was the catalyst for you to get involved in the labor movement?
Well, the catalyst that moved me to get involved is that if I'm going to work for a company or an organization, I believe that I should have some type of say-so in my labor. So that was my motivating factor. Irregardless if I was not a president or if I don't get elected, I'm going to still be active in the labor movement.
The desire to have that voice and that bringing you to the labor movement, do you think that you would have gone along as far in your career as a worker had you not been involved in the labor movement?
No. I would not have went as far as I did if I did not have that input of involvement in the labor movement.
And when you talk to potential members, encouraging them to join the union, to join 1199, what do you say to them?
My input to them is that you live in a country where you do have a right to have some say-so in your labor. And I informed them that if you are not participating or you're not a member of some type of labor organization, you're just throwing away your rights. Okay, so therefore, I encourage them from a rights perspective.
And as you move forward to the end of 2011 and into 2012, what are some of your top priorities for the local?
Some of my top priority for the local is to improve my relationship with management even more, to make it better, to do my very best to open up the channels of communication between me and my members, and to motivate my members to give more input and to be more participative in the process.
Vernon Steed, president of AFGE Air Force Local 1199 at Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. Vernon, thank you for your time and your commitment to AFGE's members.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll take you inside the Occupy Oakland movement, as well as a recent AFGE rally to support Social Security Administration workers.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
That was the chant of AFGE activists at a recent rally to show support for their Social Security Administration colleagues who are at risk of losing funding due to federal budget cuts. Attendees of AFGE's District 12 Training Conference organized the event outside the Oakland Federal Building to support all federal workers. The rally featured a number of speakers, including AFGE National Vice President for Women's and Fair Practices, Augusta Thomas, and California Labor Federation Executive Secretary Treasurer, Art Pulaski. Sylvia Norman, president of AFGE's SSA Local 3172, made her message clear.
Those that have built this country, those working people who have suffered long enough, no more I'm part of Local 3172, Social Security offices. There are 71 offices in our local. We cover all of Northern California and Northern Nevada. We're looking at all of our offices closing to the public a half an hour early. We're looking at staffing cuts. We're looking at pay freezes. The proposal is up to 2015. Federal government workers can see a freeze in their pay. We're looking at you proposing more on top of the working poor. Those of you who have dedicated your life to civil service, you deserve better than that. We're looking forward to seeing that our voices be heard through more demonstrations. There are more than 140 demonstrations going on throughout the country today. Saying no more cuts to the poor, the disabled, to the blind. No more cuts to the working middle class. No more cuts.
While in Oakland, we also had an opportunity to speak with members of the Occupy Oakland movement, which at times clashed with police. 29-year-old Oakland resident William Haar was there during the protests.
I'm out here to show solidarity and support to the people who were out here last night facing an excessive police reaction that really upset me. It really upset me that the mayor I voted for, Gene Kwan, who is one of my heroes and who I support, is basically behind the administration that ordered what I thought was an immensely excessive reaction against peaceful protesters. They were obstructing traffic, and they were taking to the streets, and that's a part of civil disobedience, and I believe that being arrested is a part of that. It's been a part of that for a very long time, and I think that people here are willing to accept that as consequences. What I think is absolutely outrageous is the idea that crowd control needs to include shooting projectiles at high velocities into crowds, shooting chemical weapons, chemical agents to disperse crowds, using truncheons. I just think this is absolutely uncalled for when it comes to crowd control. There's a lot easier ways to control a crowd than to harm people. When this plaza that I'm standing next to right now was evicted, Mayor Kwan issued a statement saying that this was because it was becoming a public health nuisance. I'm a student of public health, and I can tell you that the more than dozen people who were admitted to hospitals last night is a far more greater threat to public health than anything that's been going on here. She cited a rodent problem. Now, if she's genuinely concerned about a rodent problem, there's other ways to go about dealing with that than coming in the dark of night or the very early morning, as the case actually was, deploying tear gas and aggressively arresting 80 people. But, you know, that was her decision, and the rest of us came out. Actually, I wasn't a part of it, but people came out last night to object to that, and I think it just turned ugly really quickly.
Risa Jaffe, 56, also from Oakland, worried that the violence would diminish the Occupy message.
I believe that we make a better statement when we respect the police and we ask them to stand down. I think this is just bad media, and so what happens is people out there don't see people like me, and they don't understand that this doesn't represent the whole.
Jaffe also had a message for her fellow occupiers.
We're all in it together. It's not us against them. Come out and do your part.
Haar then went on to address what started the Occupy movement.
So the original motivation, I believe, is to address deep structural problems in our government system and in our economy. And I think there's been a lot of criticism that the Occupy movements are sort of too vague, that their aims are too nebulous. I think it's that the vision is so big. It might be easier to sort of talk about if we were to say, you know, we're opposed to this one word in the regulations that are being drafted around the Volcker Rule or something like this. But that's not what this is about. This is about addressing broader social inequities. And the way to do that is to make deep structural changes all across the board. And what are those structural changes? We have some ideas, but we also think that that's incumbent upon the policymakers and the legislators and the politicians to come up with that. They are hearing our voice. They're hearing what we're upset about. And then they're asking, well, what do you want us to do about it? No, that's your job. What are you going to do about it to meet the needs that we're pointing out?
Ultimately, Haar says the movement will only continue to grow until real change takes place.
I think this movement's going to continue to grow. I think the police reaction and the reaction of many that are frightened by this movement just shows that they know that we have ground to gain. I think we have a role to play. People here, some people are talking about revolution. I don't think we're going to overthrow a system of government. I think we're just trying to say that there is a large group of people, a plurality, if not a majority of people, who really feel that our institutions have failed us, be it government institutions or private institutions. And our mission here is just to say, we're here, we don't like it, this is what we like, and we want you to do something about it.
Thank you to our guests this week, AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel and local presidents John Garvey, Mike Garrissi, and Vernon Steed. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power.